I think we're going to start it up right now. Good evening, everybody. It is May 25th, 2007. It's Friday. We're mixing it up a little bit this week. I'm Charlie, and with me, as always, is the Uncle.
Good evening, everyone.
And we're very glad that everyone can join us for our special Memorial Day episode. Hopefully, most everyone has the week of next week. Some has Monday off, so you know you get a 3-day weekend out of the deal. And if you're a true American, you'll call in sick either Friday or Tuesday and make that a 4-dayer. So here's to everybody being able to pull that one off. So you got some good plans for the Memorial Day holiday, Uncle?
Well, I think I'm going to spend a large portion of the Memorial Day weekend drinking.
That is as American as apple pie. Very good.
And, you know, there may be a barbecue in my future as well.
Good. I think I got some sort of cooking meat lined up for Monday, which is an excellent thing to do for the Memorial Day. And certainly we're not withstraining our drinking. Withstraining is a good word. To the weekend, so that we can give you all a good podcast for tonight. So,
of course.
Yeah, now, just...
And also, Charlie, I mean, Memorial Day. What is the point of Memorial Day? It is to remember... You know what, I actually don't know what Memorial Day is. Is this for the troops?
Well, you know, I like the troops. We can just say it's for the troops because it's good to remember the troops. They're doing their best. I think Memorial Day...
But not only do we honor and remember the troops, we honor and remember so many interesting facets of pop culture gone by.
This is so true. Memorial Day, out of every holiday just about, certainly a national holiday, probably has the closest relation and pertinence to the Preserve and to the Uncle Cast of any holiday that I can immediately think of off the top of my head. So here's to Memorial Day, tying in so well with what we do here at the Preserve. And you know, thinking of remembering the past, really, if you want to think about video games, very few things are more important than when the video game home system first realized that games could be made cartridge-based, which means that for the early part of the 70s, games were programmed into the unit. And even with the Odyssey 1, all those games were pre-stored in the unit, and though there were cartridges that you put in, they acted kind of like jumpers, and they just selected for one of the pre-programmed games.
Is that true?
It really is. It really is.
All of the games were pre-programmed in the Odyssey.
Yeah, and you know,
I did not know
that.
There
weren't many. And remember, this is the Odyssey 1, not the Odyssey 2. The Odyssey 2 had a fairly sizable library, 30-something games. Some are harder to find than others. I'm working on that collection, of course. So the Odyssey 2 was a legitimate cartridge-based game system, but the first one that really made that leap and realized, hey, why don't we take this logic that's in the system and we put it in these little handheld cartridges, and oh my god, we've all of a sudden just made our system able to play, instead of three
An
games,
exponentially
100,000 games if people felt like programming them. It just is such a wonderful leap, that leap that has to be made. And it was made really by the Fairchild Channel F. And the Fairchild Channel F is a system that I didn't have in the Preserve for many years. I certainly never had it new because it was mid-70s. And I'd heard about it from here and there, and I'd read about it a little bit. And I finally bit the bullet a few weeks ago, about a month ago. And due to my savvy eBaying, because of my tremendous amounts of time I spend on there, I was able to score one. The prices for the Fairchild have really gone crazy, as I've probably ranted about, such that...
Now, yeah. Charlie, I'd like to jump in here just for a little
Please.
Bit and throw my spin onto it. I would posit, and of course this is based on nothing other than just my own bias, how are the games? Would you say the games are really excellent examples of gameplay and game design for the time?
You know, okay, I'm glad that you ended your sentence that way, for the time, because that's important. Because the... Between like the early part of the 70s and the mid-70s, basically everything was a variation on Pong. It was almost all Pong, and they just called it something different, or they changed the background color from blue to red. Like, it was pretty hilarious. And, you know, that was probably pretty hip. But honestly, it was all Pong. And the Fairchild, honestly, I have not played very many games for the Fairchild. And let's call it what it is, folks. I've played no games for the Fairchild. Today, in the U.S. Postal Service mail, I received a box of games for my Fairchild Channel F. So now is my first chance I've ever had to play these games. I still haven't, you know, had a chance to sit down and do that. So
Well, reality has a troubling way of getting in the way of playing video games.
I know
that all too well.
It does. It does. And the reality of not owning any made it difficult. The set that I bought online, well, let me answer your question as well as I can, which is from the screenshots I've seen, at least they were making an effort to do something other than Pong. The graphics weren't much better, but they were kind of thinking, you know, let's really do whatever we can, you know, even if it kind of is the same hardware that's driving it, you know, let's get away from the Pong model. You know, we're not just going to do tennis, volleyball, soccer, whatever you want to call it, and it's basically Pong.
Yes,
yeah. Precisely, air hockey. And they really kind of tried to get away from that model, and which is great because that means they pushed that envelope in terms of the gameplay and also just revolutionized the entire hardware concept of home video games. So
now, you had spoken about the price, and just, again, my comment on this is perhaps because, unlike, I'd like to draw the comparison with the Atari, where if you go into the toy store or a common toy store in the personal electronics section, you'll be able to buy something that plugs directly into your TV with a classically styled Atari controller, and you'll be able to play 25 to 30 games. Do you think the price of the Fairchild, the games, are so high because you cannot do this? So basically, if you do want to relive your youth and play the games that you grew up playing as a kid, the only way to do it is by buying the originals, and maybe that's why the secondary eBay market, the prices are so high.
I think that is an excellent assessment. You know, with anything that can't be replicated elsewhere, you're definitely going to get that collector dollar feverishly thrown towards it. And I think that's a very good point. You know, it doesn't have that kind of notoriety that Atari does, and even, you know, that Sega and Nintendo do. And I think certainly for people who were buying this, and it was, you know, they were growing up in the 70s, they're a little older than I am, and they have probably an even better job and even more discretionary
income
to waste upon
that's
these.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's a very good idea. But you know what? Now, let me point this out, though. Unfortunately, eBay makes it very clear that it is the obsessive collector market, under which I often fall, that is buying these games. Because you can buy one, a loose cartridge, for a couple dollars, but as soon as that loose cartridge has the box and the instructions, we're talking $10, $20, $30. And so, you know, either way, okay, $10, $20, $30, yes, it's expensive, but it's a tremendous difference from the loose cartridge. So I think if it was purely nostalgia, you know, we would not see that price gap. So I think there's nostalgia at work, but also really that kind of collector mentality. And it might be driven by nostalgia, saying, you know, I remember the system, I want to play it, but if I'm going to buy these things, let me get all the stuff because I remember as a kid, you know, I had the instruction book. And, man, that'd be kind of cool. I'm willing to spend another $30 to get the instruction book. So, you know.
Now, see, I think this is where you and I have fundamental differences in our collecting.
Oh, yes.
Again, I grew up playing the Nintendo Entertainment System. I consider it to be my older brother.
Yeah.
That's how much time I spent playing it. And while I think it would be really cool to have an original, I very vividly remember the gray box and the art of something like Castlevania II: Simon's Quest,
uh-huh.
I couldn't really see myself spending a lot of money on it, only because I still have my original cart and manual. I don't have the box, and it doesn't, you know, really look as cool.
Yeah.
But by the same time, anytime I want to play Castlevania II: Simon's Quest, all I have to do is pop in my newly refurbished Nintendo Entertainment System, done, of course, by Charlie, into my television, and, you know, I can just relive that game. But for you, it's almost like you need the tactile sensation of having the box and the original packaging. And I would also argue the original shrink wrap. And, you know, if it has the original price, you know, from what my understanding of you, that's just like,
oh, bonus. Man, if it has the original price from, like, Clover Stores or Sears.
Or, like,
yeah,
Lionel Kitty City
or
Defunct Chain.
Or, you know, KB,
yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, that's a tremendous bonus. But, you know, that probably ties into my drive to archive stuff in terms of providing a historical record for what this stuff cost and where it was purchased originally. And I'm not so down with the shrink wrap, though packaging is nice. For instance, in an original Nintendo cart, there was a styrofoam spacer at the bottom of each box that made sure the game, you know, which was much shorter than
fall
the box.
Out.
No, the game was shorter than the box, but with the styrofoam spacer, it kept it right at the top. So when you open the flap, the game was right there instead of like halfway down in the box, you know. You didn't have to fish for it. It was right there. And so without that styrofoam spacer, you know, it's just the little things that kind of erode the experience. Because, you know, some crazy dude in Japan designed that to be perfect. And without the styrofoam spacer, it's just not quite as cool. So while I feel like a total douchebag when I argue about styrofoam spacers, it is part of the overall experience and kind of important in that regard.
You know what, though? I take issue to your comment of some Japanese guy designing it perfectly.
Huh?
The boxes for the original NES suck. Whenever I used to open them when I was a child, I would always bend the top flap, and it would never be flush and even and as perfect as it was when
oh,
it was unopened. I don't know if you know what I'm talking
about.
I'm terrified
to open my old games for exactly that
reason. I would, like, paw at them with my small fingers. I really didn't care about the condition. I wanted to get to the game. I wanted to play it. I would bend the flap. It would never rest even, and it just looked terrible.
That is precisely,
you know what I mean.
Absolutely, and that is precisely why it's so difficult to find, you know, good examples of these
mint
games.
Right. Mint games, the boxes, because they just got knocked around, and of course, like so many other important collectibles, no one thought they would be worth anything, and they got thrown out, so the supply is very low.
But again, you know, I feel it's important to ground this a little bit by saying, you know, I am all for kids enjoying their stuff. You know, I don't want to be the 30-something curmudgeon, like, comic book store guy who says that people should never, you know, touch the stuff. Now I try not to touch it much, just because it's so old, it'll fall apart. But,
right.
You know, back in the day, like, I played with every single one of my Transformers. I took them to friends' houses. Like, I played my Nintendo games incessantly. So, you know, I am definitely all about people playing with their stuff, and that is precisely why now I have such an affection for it. So without that, there wouldn't be this affection that is experienced now. So that's tremendously key. But it is sad that, really, even given the best of intentions, it was impossible not to damage the box. But yes, you know, in childhood indiscretion, yeah, those boxes are going to get torn all to hell in the effort to get
right.
The game. Definitely. It speaks merely, I guess, to my OCD that mine aren't worse than they are. Surprising how careful I must have been as a child, because I certainly played a lot of them, you know, constantly. I think maybe what I did is I didn't put the games back in the boxes often, and I just, once I opened it, I just kind of set the box aside. Who knows? That's probably how it went.
I like that you had a system in place. With me, it was just get the game out of the package as soon as possible and start playing it as soon as possible.
There you go.
Because it's like a new friend has joined the party.
Yeah.
You know, I have a new item with which I can use.
Big Brother is even
hours.
Better now, right?
Exactly. It's wonderful.
It's,
but you know what? I think this ties back to your previous discussion about the black box NES games. You had talked about the boxes, and I was just remembering the very iconic silver bars on either side of the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I really, even though it's iconic and it's drilled into my memory, I don't think it was a great way to show off games, because really, these games were sold, at least to me in my young mind, on the strength of their cover art.
Yeah.
And those silver borders on the side of these awesome paintings that they had done, especially for, you know, the first couple of Castlevanians,
mm-hmm.
it was just completely cut off by these stupid silver bars.
Yeah,
and then if you look at Mario 3, they totally lost that, and they just, you know, it's just Mario in that very iconic, he's got the raccoon tail and the ears, and he's flying, and the whole box is yellow.
Yeah.
With no borders to be seen anywhere.
Yeah. That's true.
So do you know when that changeover just happened, or was that just a special thing done for Mario 3?
You know, man, that is probably a whole specialized discipline all on its own, looking at the evolution of the box art.
The box art of Nintendo and the box design.
Yeah.
Because now, come to think of it, Legend of Zelda didn't have the silver bars either.
No, Legend of Zelda totally blew the doors off of all previous design. Like, it even had a cutout. One of the panels in the front was
right.
cut out, so
one
you
of
could
the panels
see the gold cartridge within, and talk about a good marketing plan.
Mm.
And
you know,
speaking of gold cartridges, Uncle, that reminds me of something you and I were discussing earlier, but it ties back to this Fairchild Channel F discussion, if I can kind of short-circuit us back in that direction.
Oh, certainly, by all means.
So, like, I finally decided to get a Fairchild Channel F on eBay, and I found a good one, got it for, like, $30 with the box, of course, because the box is important for me, and no games, whatever, and the day after I won it, or an hour after I won it, this fellow wrote me, and his name's Dennis Drew. And he asked if I would be able to spare one of the pamphlets that it came with. And at first I was like, oh, I don't know, whatever. And, you know, he said he's a collector, he has this massive Fairchild collection, and that he did not have one of these pamphlets, and that he had actually been bidding against me in the auction, and I had managed to win the item. Because, you know, it makes sense that he wouldn't bid too much because he, I'm sure, already has this hardware. He just really wanted that pamphlet because he's a really serious, serious collector, it seems, from what I've gotten to know. And you know, we made a deal, and I ended up selling him the pamphlet and mailed it to him, and he's turned out to be a really fascinating fellow and a great resource about a lot of information I don't have. I think he's been into kind of the more structured side of this hobby longer than I have, more than just kind of, you know, I was into it because I grew up with it, but I think he's kind of treated it more with like a research and a investigative and more of the CSI approach, if you will, for more years than I have. And so he has really been communicating with me and sharing a lot of interesting points about the Fairchild. He also has a fabulous website that details almost every variation that certainly that he has come across of the cartridges and the marketing material and I believe some advertisements that is online.
Charlie, why don't you plug the website? What's the address of that website?
Well, the address is a little complicated because it's off of his main reseller address. So what I'll do is I'll put it in the show notes. So everybody should go in the show notes and check out the link to his Fairchild tribute page.
Cool.
So Dennis is doing a great job, and he recently wrote me a few days ago, actually, because I had posted something on the Preserve saying, well, look at this amazing price that these Fairchild cartridges just went for. 12 cartridges sold on eBay the other day with the boxes and the instructions for $250 for all 12.
Wow.
And I was keeping an eye out because the box I bought didn't have any games, and I really kind of wanted some games in my system. But I was watching that because, look, they're all in box. That'd be nice. And I thought, holy cow, that's amazing. So I post on the Preserve, like, look at that. That's another example of these amazing prices. And he wrote me, and he said, yeah, I was actually bidding on that auction. I was the bid right before the guy who won. Like, he bid $300 or he bid, like, just below $300 and then got sniped by some other guy. And it turns out that number 13, I believe he told me, cartridge number 13, because Fairchild cartridges are numbered with these giant, like, 1970s numbers on the front. They're awesome. You really got to see the box.
Oh, that's great.
It's like 1, 2. And so he said cartridge number 13, which I think is a soccer game, is extremely rare. And he said he'd never seen one on eBay before.
And this is the only time he'd actually seen an example?
That's what he told me. And he said it was part of the set. And that was his explanation for why the price was so high. And so I had to kind of recant a little bit. And I said, you know, that's great, because I fully believe that a lot of the stuff I post on the Preserve is kind of underinformed when I say, man, look at the price this went for. It's totally ludicrous. But it could, you know, every time I point out a group of something, it could be there's that one cartridge that really drove
that's driving the entire price of the lot, that essentially the hardcore collectors have every other piece of
the
collection.
Right, exactly.
But it's just that one rare item that they haven't been able to get their hands on.
It's worth that $300 to somebody who's been looking for it for years to get that piece, and they'd, like, throw away the rest, you know. Hopefully they'd resell it or give it to somebody, but they're just, you know, laser beam focus on that one cartridge number 13, which is what Dennis was doing.
And again, you know, Dennis strikes me as the kind of guy, he probably has most of the entire collection of these games, with the exception of 13. 13 has probably haunted him for a while.
Precisely. That was my thought, too. And so I did manage to win another auction, and it was funny because I won the cartridge number 1 with the box, the instructions, a poster. It looks in beautiful shape, and that just arrived today for $1. I won this, you know, total, complete. And then I won five other cartridges, and it kind of random numbers like number 1, 2, 3, 7, and 11 or something like that. And I got them each for $1. Now, the other ones, not number 1, were just the cartridge, and so I'm violating my cardinal rule of not, you know, waiting to buy them in box. But this ties back to your earlier question of my assessment of the Fairchild games, and I was feeling the pressure. You know, I've got the system. I really ought to have some games for it. So when I saw people weren't interested in this auction, all from the same dude, I said, all right, I'll buy a couple of his lots, you know, saves on shipping, blah, blah, blah. So I got all the stuff in today. It's pretty cool. But Dennis wrote me after seeing that post, and he said, yeah, that's funny that you think that's a lot of money, because check this out. And he told me about a Nintendo cartridge called World Championship, I believe. And he said that there were gold ones, and there were gray ones, and there were only about 90 gray ones, and there were only about 26 gold ones. And,
wow.
And that these games were given out as prizes at a special event. And he sent me some links, and the links are up on the Preserve right now, I believe the May 25th journal entry. And this game typically goes for between $5,000 and $15,000. This car's
unbelievable.
This on eBay, and he has examples of it. It's really astonishing.
And Charlie,
yeah.
The most remarkable thing that I think about World Champion is that it's not even a complete game.
No?
It takes a snippet. I was reading your wonderful links from links. I checked out eBay, and then eBay had a link that said, click this to learn more. It basically is you play a segment from the first Super Mario Brothers. You play a segment from Rad Racer where you have infinite time and you have to beat the race in the fastest time and score the most points. And then you have a segment in Tetris.
No way.
And the whole point, the game only lasts 6 minutes.
So it's all based around that competition. They probably had kids actually play this as part of the competition.
As part of the Nintendo Power Tour or whatever it was called in 1990, kids would actually play this. And, you know, I guess they had different age brackets. And I guess the winner of I guess the tour stop got the gold one, and the finalists had got the gray one.
Wow.
And in terms of, I could almost see it being justified if it was a unique game.
Yeah, but it's
meaning
not
you even couldn't get the game. It's not even a unique. It's basically like playing 2 minutes of the first Super Mario Brothers,
yeah.
2 minutes of Rad Racer, and 2 minutes of Tetris. And it's fetching, you know.
I just blew my mind how much they want for it.
It's absolutely
or not even
amazing.
That they want for it, how much people are willing to pay. It's the amazing part. And Uncle, I think even more than the price of this cartridge, which is a total something I can't wrap my mind around, even more astonishing than that is a secret, a bit of knowledge, a bit of your past that you shared with me when we were discussing this issue, and I think that we should cut back to that issue after our intermission.
I think you guys, listeners, do not change the dial. Do not stop listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoy the intermission. It is a very special one. And we will leave you on this cliffhanger, but we will return to it after the intermission.
That's right, folks. You don't want to miss this. We'll be right back.
The one with all the fun. The Fairchild Video Entertainment System at your larger JCPenney. The home entertainment system that never gets old. Plug in a new video card and change the fun. Play tic-tac-toe, shooting gallery, or just doodle. Switch video cards and play Desert Fox. Switch again, it's blackjack. Or play the two built-in games, pro hockey or tennis champ. Channel F for fun. The Fairchild Video Entertainment System. Just $169.95. Video card cartridges, $19.95 each. At your larger JCPenney.
Everybody, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did.
Yes. Now, as Charlie left all you listeners dangling from a cliffhanger-like scenario, talking about how this had something to do with my very own past,
right.
The fact of the matter is that it did. My wonderful father woke me up early one morning. I wiped the sleep out of my eyes, and I wondered why he was getting me up so early on a Saturday. It was very early, much earlier than I normally would get to watch cartoons.
So this was a surprise.
This was totally a surprise. I had no idea. He woke me up early on a Saturday and had three tickets in his hand. And those tickets were for the 1990 Nintendo Power World Tour to be held at the Jacob Javits Center, which is a pretty huge convention center in Manhattan. Well, that's actually a lie. It's huge. It's a huge convention center in Manhattan. It's not huge in terms of actual convention center spaces because, you know, if you go to a place like Indiana, there's really not – the land is not nearly as ridiculously expensive.
They can build big convention centers in Indiana, right?
That's precisely right. So anyway, my father, myself, and my cousin on this one awesome Saturday when I was in second grade in the year 1990 – went into the city and went to the Jacob Javits Center, and it was just awesome. I remember walking in to just a convention hall, and for as far as the eye could see, they had kiosks set up of Nintendo games that hadn't been released yet. I remember playing probably a month or two before it was released, Ninja Gaiden 2.
Nice.
I believe it's called The Dark Sword of Chaos. I also played Codename Viper, another great Nintendo
wow.
game, which has gameplay similar to the Rolling Thunder. I also actually remember watching. I was too young to compete, but I actually watched kids playing this World Championship cart.
Fantastic.
And so when I clicked on this, it totally was like a bolt. It was like my memory was shocked, and I remembered actually watching, it was so cool because you would go up on stage and you would play on this huge big screen monitor.
The Wizard.
Just like The Wizard. It was just like The Wizard,
wow.
Charlie. And I remember watching it and thinking to myself, man, that would be so cool if I got to play.
Oh, Uncle.
But, you know...
How amazing that this cartridge came off that reminded you of all this.
Yeah, no, and it totally, like, I hadn't thought about it in such a long time, you know. But it just, I remember going, there was also one thing that I wish I had done, but at the time I thought it was the stupidest thing ever. They had this set, it was made to look like the Mushroom Kingdom from Super Mario Brothers. They had, like, a warp pipe, a brick, and, like, you know, a blue backdrop with a cloud and like, a painted latitude.
That is awesome.
And I guess what they were having kids do was, like, they played the music and you made a video.
No.
And, like, I remember thinking at the time, like, watching some, like, 5-year-old girls dance around that, and they played the Super Mario Brothers theme song and being like, screw this, I want to play Ninja Gaiden, like, whatever, I'm not doing that. That's for babies. And, like, if I had a video of my 8-year-old self in the Mushroom Kingdom dancing around like an idiot, it would just be a gem. It would be something I could bring out at parties when everyone was
And with that backstory, everybody would say you're the man, because that is an incredible experience.
But I wouldn't even introduce it. I would just say, I found this really weird VHS tape. I think it's kind of funny. You know, maybe you might like to see it. And if
awesome.
Someone, you know, pestered me, I'd be like, I just bought it. And then as I slowly popped it in, and the horrible truth was, you know, dawned on them.
Dude.
That it was actually the uncle dancing around as an 8-year-old.
At the Nintendo Power Convention.
At the 1990 Nintendo Power Convention at the Jacob Javits Center in Manhattan. Minds would be blown out.
Nobody would recover from that. That's just amazing.
Skulls would be blown out of the back of people's heads,
yeah,
Charlie.
Absolutely.
It would just be mind-blowing.
I wonder if anywhere on YouTube, and you are the YouTube master, if someone has one of these videos, and I have to imagine they don't, because it sounds like an amazingly rare thing. But if
well, it wasn't, I guess, it, you know, it was just a promotional thing that I guess, you know, you could do if you had younger kids and, you know, you wanted to make, like, a little video for them. You could go up there, and I guess you pay a small fee, and they give you a VHS copy of this tape.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wouldn't put it past some sicko on YouTube who has the ability to convert VHS tapes into whatever format YouTube broadcasts and then posting it.
Oh, absolutely. I feel disappointed if that hadn't happened, in fact.
And this is a great point of yours. I'm actually going to mine YouTube tonight
probably
into the weekend and try to look for this, because if we could get some
grainy
video of what could have been, I think it would be very awesome.
If we turn anything up, you know, as much as I don't usually link to YouTube, I will definitely put that in the show notes and also rave about it on the journal so that people are sure not to miss it, because that just sounds like something that has to be seen.
Yeah.
Now, God, what a great, just, it sounds like it's like E3, but all for Nintendo and all for, like, the actual kids who are enjoying the games instead of the dorks in the press and the media. Like, what a great event this sounds like.
Charlie, I could be wrong, because this, of course, happened many years ago.
Yeah.
I was young at the time. I think, I'm not certain, but I think there actually was a theater. There was a viewing room.
Wow.
And I specially went into this viewing room to watch a movie of gameplay footage from Super Mario Brothers 3.
No.
I think this was prior to the launch of Super Mario
and
Brothers 3.
And probably even prior to The Wizard.
I think this also predated The Wizard. I don't know. I have to check the years. This is probably when The Wizard was actually filming. Like, I don't know what year it came out. I want to say 1991. It could be 1990.
Yeah.
I don't know if time works out. But I remember watching in this theater in the Javits Center gameplay footage of the upcoming Super Mario Brothers 3, which was like, I consider it, I mean, it was like the White Album of video games.
Yes,
like,
it's true.
I don't know if that makes any sense, and like everyone could not wait for
it. I remember the burning anticipation for that game, 100%.
And, you know, it wasn't until much later that I had found out that the real reason why Super Mario Brothers 2 was so weird was because it was completely not Super Mario Brothers.
It was a totally
Brothers
different game that took for the
It was a Japanese game called Doki Doki Panic that they just replaced all the sprites with, you know, Mario, Luigi, Peach, and Toad.
Yeah.
And that's why there's like Peach and Birdo and Oceans and all that weird stuff. There's no stars. And so anyway, the third one was a triumphant return and a hallmark of a game, one of the greatest video games of
Back
all time.
Back to
it did not disappoint.
Yeah, exactly. But, and now, Now, something that you really tied everything together with is, you know, what would happen when these kids won? What did the winner get?
Oh, the winner of the this contest that I went to would actually get the gold carts you were talking about.
And there we go. There,
the highest score would get the gold cart, and I believe, you know, second and third place, or I don't know how they did it, maybe top 10, got the gray carts, and that's why these things are so rare.
And so now we see that the price for somebody's first victory as a child, as an entity in this world, their first shining moment of triumph, you know, the price to buy that from them is about $15,000, so I guess that still commands something. Very nice.
And, you know, at least initially, I mean, that's definitely a cartridge I would never get rid of. However, $15,000 is a lot of money. And I think that would really be a tough quandary to put myself into. If I had actually gotten one of these games and it was not lost or destroyed, which, of course, is a huge...
Yeah, big if.
Yeah, that's a massive if right there. I don't know. I might have a tough time because... $15,000 is a lot. I mean, that's a lot. You can do a lot with that amount of money.
Yeah, man, and that's on eBay, which means, you know, tax situation's interesting, too. So, hey, there you go.
Exactly. More power to you, you know, and if someone's willing, some collector's willing to pay it, you know, who am I to say no?
That's right. You could be driving around in a brand new, vehicle of
whatever
some sort. And,
yeah,
you know.
Put that down and that's $15,000 down on a, what is it, a Dodge Viper. No,
oh, well,
that's not enough for Dodge.
You could put a small
Ford. But a Ford Mustang,
that's right.
I could certainly fulfill my dream of having a, you know, down payment on
and
a Ford Mustang.
And you could get a silk screened picture of that cartridge on the door of the Mustang so that you'd always remember it and you'd say, all right, this cartridge.
Phenomenal. This is the cartridge that bought my Mustang.
Yep, that's right. Now, see, I know that's super dorky, but I still think it's pretty cool.
No, I think that's awesome. Yeah. It's a great story.
Yeah. Now, well. And, of course, this is an interesting thought about how difficult it is to part with things. And certainly, in order to part with things, you have to accumulate things. And that's a problem that I know you and I both kind of wrestle with. And we use various techniques and methods to rationalize our behavior. But I know we've kind of got some new thoughts on the matter. And maybe you can state those better than me.
Well, I'd like to call my theory on collecting and amassing aggressive deterrent. Aggressive deterrence, rather. And what that says is, if you're already involved in a line or two, and by line I mean something like Transformers
mm-hmm.
or Star Wars or something that's collectible and is released in the retail 2 to 3 times a year and just seems like a complete money drain and you'll never actually be complete with it, whatever you do, do not open the door to get involved in more collections, because you will just dilute whatever money you would use to collect among more and more collections. And what it really comes down to is, like, do you want a lot of one type, or do you want a few types of a lot of different things? And my father, he said to me, Chris, you can't have it all. And he's right. Many times when I look online at people's collections and they have some form of order and semblance, it looks better than someone that just says, like, oh, well, here's my one Jedi and my one Transformer, my one G.I. Joe,
yeah.
My one Captain Power, my one McFarlane, my one Dragon Ball Z, my one Inuyasha, my one Pokemon. You know, I see that and I'm like, you're kind of boring.
Yeah.
I think it looks cooler to have a lot of a certain type of thing.
It shows more dedication. It shows more focus.
It really does. I mean... Who really wants to look at a collection and have it look like an explosion in a toy store?
Right. Yeah.
It's really nice to have, you know, different collections sectioned off, maybe you have a couple, but you really limit yourself. And what this really states is that if you have the collecting mentality and you see something you like of a line of which you have nothing, don't buy it. Because like many things, it's easier to not get hooked if you never even start.
Oh, isn't that the truth? I mean, your father had some real sage advice, and you've distilled it down to a really good nugget here of wisdom. And yeah, absolutely. If you know you have this predisposition, and you see something that's kind of cool, but you should just understand it's a slippery slope. And, you know, Lord knows I'm the wrong person to be giving this advice. And, you know, God love the uncle for trying to tell me the wise things I should know. But certainly I'm the one who, along with these Fairchild Channel F games that I got, went and purchased a few RCA Studio 2 games. Because clearly I need to start collecting the RCA Studio 2. Now I have four games for it. This came out, in fact, Uncle, months after the Fairchild, and was a cartridge-based system. So it would have been the first, but Fairchild beat it to market. And much like Beta and VHS, it faded away. Unlike Beta, it was not as good as the Fairchild. It was black and white, the graphics weren't as good, so it really didn't stand a chance, but it was out
Charlie, there. It's very funny that you brought up Beta and VHS. I was just, earlier today, I was over at my friend Dan's house. We were having a little discussion about the format wars between HD, DVD, and Blu-ray. Ah. And he had told me, he said, Chris, do you know the reason why Betamax failed? And I said, no, not really. He said, well, it was cheaper and it was a better format, but the reason it failed was because pornography went over to VHS.
Correct.
And that's actually true?
Yes, that is.
Wow. Ooh.
In fact, that Ooh, is thunk. What is driving the HD, DVD, and Blu-ray thing right now.
Is it real? Like has pornography
cast They have chosen one. I believe they chose the HD, DVD. Yeah.
Really?
I think. They chose the one that's not Sony's, because I know Sony keeps getting screwed in the
Sony's game. Blu-ray.
Yeah. Just like
okay.
Sony was Beta. Yeah.
That's really interesting, because he was also telling me they finally come out with the technology for players that play both.
Oh, well, that's true. But I think one will lose, probably.
Oh, of course.
You know, granted, because of the nature of the media, it's a disc instead of a totally different sized cartridge. It is more convenient to just kind of have a player that does both. It's more transparent, I guess, is what I'm saying, instead of, like, a VHS tape was so big and so physical, you had to have two different slots. The end user has to think about it more, whereas if it's just a disc, the end user can kind of be tricked and not really even know. You know, you don't have to care what format it is, but...
Right, that's true. And it also...
Win.
I mean, DVDs are a $1 billion business, and you don't want to have a situation where, for example... Mom and Dad, or Grandma and Grandpa, want to buy Little Timmy a DVD of the new animated Pixar/Disney/massive conglomerate entertainment entity that has animated voices of Justin Timberlake and Cameron Diaz. And everyone falls in love at the
My
end.
Favorite.
You know, any one of those 75 different movies that are presently out, and Little Timmy puts it in and it says disc not recognized, and he starts
that's
crying
a dark day.
Because it's the wrong because it's the wrong format. Like you just, in terms of ease, consumer ease, you really just want one disc, and a format war is completely stupid.
Yeah,
and I would almost argue beyond the ken of this podcast.
No. Most likely.
Other than the very,
I feel that your friend maybe ought to do a guest interview on one of our Uncle Casts.
We may have to have him. He might be a suitable first guest. He's a very unique individual. He's very opinionated. He has some great content.
Well, perfect.
I think he'd be able to splash.
Fantastic. Well, now, Uncle, I'm wondering, because this is really a big topic that we've opened up here. Would you like to delve further into our topic in our next Uncle Cast?
I think that's a phenomenal idea, Charlie. I think we will give our wonderful audience a teaser, a preview, if you will, of the upcoming topic of our next Uncle Cast.
All right.
And, everyone stay tuned. We are so glad that you listen. We hope you have a wonderful Memorial Day. You have a lot of hot dogs, hamburgers, potato salad, and beer.
Oh, man, that sounds
if you like that sort of thing.
That's right. Everybody live it up, enjoy, and get ready for a further discussion in our next Uncle Cast about the care that must be taken with a collector mentality of buying that first thing.
Excellent.
All right, Uncle. Well, it was fantastic to talk to you today. Have a great week, and we will...
Great to talk to you,
That's right, man. We'll do this again soon.
Certainly.
All right, bye.
Bye.